It gives me great pleasure to introduce Fabian Neuhaus, who will be talking about quality and gatekeeping, and I may interrupt.
This is the first time my co-speaker introduced me. That's a novelty.
Speaking to the microphone.
Okay, so we are talking about quality and gatekeeping, and in the beginning, I will try to summarize the results of our discussion, which has been done mainly by email. And I try to do and keep it short but informative so that people who didn't actually participate in the discussions get an overview of what we did so far. Our topic is actually two different topics. We are talking about gatekeeping. Is this... We're talking about gatekeeping, which is about the minimal requirements that ontologies need to meet if they want to be part of the repository. And we're talking about quality. The question is here, how do we distinguish between, or how do we recognize and encourage high-quality ontologies in the repository? And so the first one is our... first one we answered with a list of quality criteria that we discussed, and the first one is actually one I don't want to discuss right now, so it's just mentioned here, openness, and we will actually spend quite some time later in discussing what openness means in detail and the various positions we had on this question. Second, we all was already mentioned, the ontology needs to be expressed in a formal language with a well-defined syntax. And by formal language, I mean a language where you have a grammar, which defines the language, and this is required in order to do, for example, syntax checking. It's not necessarily the case that the formal language needs to have a semantics, but of course that would be nice. The third one is the authors provide the required metadata. This begs the question, what is the required metadata? And here I point to the next session, where we actually talk about what kinds of metadata is valuable to have and necessary to have for an open ontology repository. I just put it in here and to make clear that metadata is not just an option. It's not a nice thing to have, but it's a necessary thing that anybody who submits their ontology needs to provide. Otherwise, we are not going to be able, as users, to find the ontologies that we want quickly and efficiently and with the for the purposes that we need them to have. The next three are what I think more or less trivial one. The ontology needs a clearly specified and delineated scope. This should be given in short form of a short abstract so that people don't need to open an ontology, browse an ontology, just to find out what's in it. Successive versions are clearly identified. I think I don't need to argue why that's important. And the ontology is adequately labeled. Again, looking at the title, you should know what the ontology is about. I, for example, am part of a group who published an ontology which is called CARO, so I'm guilty of naming an ontology in a way that nobody knows what it means. If I would have named it a Common Anatomy Reference Ontology, which is actually what CARO stands for, then people would know what it's about. Okay, so these are the gatekeeping criteria that we discussed. Obviously, these gatekeeping criteria are not going to enforce any high quality, and that was the result of the discussion. The gatekeeping should be very low and should be low bar. So it is important that users are able to evaluate the ontologies within the repository, and the repository needs to give the users the tool to do this evaluation and to find easily good ontologies. And when we discussed that, it became quickly apparent that there are very different perspectives on ontologies. Some see them mostly as pieces of software, some as pictures of reality, some see them as standards documents. And depending on what perspective you have, and depending on what use cases you want your ontologies to use for, you have different opinions, or it's likely that there are differences of opinions, on how ontologies should be evaluated. There was no consensus on what is the right way of ontology evaluation, and but there were two main proponents. One idea is the market-driven idea, where you have a social networking kind of tools which allow just everybody to rank the ontologies in the way they think it's the right way, and say whether it's useful for what they wanted to do or not. And the other way is the review-based system, which works similar to reviews of scientific texts. So the review, there would be a review board which organizes reviews and gives kind of grades afterwards. And Natasha developed a tool, I think, who supports, or it's part of the BioPortal, which allows already evaluation, if I understand that. And the second strategy is embraced by the OBO Foundry, where basically the board of the OBO Foundry tells people, well, your ontology is good enough, you're in the club and part of the OBO Foundry, and or they say, no, you have to work in specific ways. I really would like to just go through the presentation and then we have a discussion. So the result of the discussion was, okay, both approaches make sense. They're obviously not mutually exclusive. Obviously, one can rank and evaluate ontologies on both ways, and ideally, a repository would support both approaches. We don't know yet what kind of approach will generate more trust, and it may be also the case that different ontologies, different domains produce different ontologies which need to be evaluated in different ways. Another conclusion of the discussion was that people argued for a distributed governance model, so there is not going to be one monolithic group which is going to vote whether an ontology is good or bad, but this is going to be organized by subcommunities. And each community can evaluate the ontologies according to standards which are make sense for their communities. So these are the three kind of requirements, or the three things on the wish list for the people who build in the repository. Please allow us to have social networking features which allow us to do an ontology evaluation, and allow subcommunities which can do the evaluation in the sense of a review board or a scientific journal. Okay, that was just my introduction. There are two topics I want to resolve, and these are the two questions here. And what does open mean in OOR? There was a long discussion about that. And I don't want to have a general debate on what is open and it is good and or is it not good or something like that, but it's just meant in the context as a gateway criterion. So what are the minimal criteria which any ontology has to meet? That's the question. How much openness do we have to ask for? And I will present two extreme positions that I've seen during the discussion. And the other discussion is something we will talk about later, is do we need a quality gatekeeping criterion? Nothing in the gatekeeping so far said anything about quality. These were all formal things. And we had a long discussion about that, and I think we made a lot of progress, but the gap is closer, but it's not. There is still a gap between the different positions. I would suggest that we have now discussions about the general content, what I presented so far. Try to limit that to at most 20 minutes. And then have focus on the openness discussion. I think Peter might also give us a short introduction there. And afterwards come back to the quality gatekeeping criteria. Okay. Mark.
I was going to say earlier, Fabian, that almost is a false dichotomy, because a user who wants to evaluate an ontology may well be interested in what the market says and may well be interested in what a particular review board might say.
Oh, and I thought I said that these approaches are not mutually exclusive, so I certainly didn't want to say that the dichotomy. It is just I wanted to summarize the discussion, and these were the two most prominent models of evaluation that we have discussed. They actually, I forgot to mention that, there are actually more material. Mark and Ram, who is not here, organized a workshop on, organized a workshop on ontology evaluation last October, and I have on my last slide, where I have resources, the address where you can find the results of that workshop. So that was just, I just tried to, summarize and come up with the two main topics I could recognize in the discussion on evaluation. John?
Whenever there's an thesis and an antithesis, you want to look for a synthesis, and I would recommend the April issue of the Communications of the ACM, which had an article on the European Provenance Project for Electronic Data. And that's a rather short article, but they have a pointer to their website. And there's a lot of resources there, and they are talking about the methodology and the tools that they've got, and with applications to both medical data and to aircraft data. And they've been keeping track of where the data comes from, who made the definitions, who made the decisions, and tracing all the way back. And that is something that could be applied to either of these two strategies, because what it does is give you the tools provide mechanisms for keeping track of everything and why it happened this way, who did it, and why, who used it, and everything. Now, I'm not saying that it precludes either of these two, but it gives you a way of keeping all that data so that anybody who makes a decision, either market-driven or review-based, can make it on the basis of all that data. Now, I have not used these tools myself. I just looked at their website, but I think that anybody who's working on something like this might want to look at their website and just evaluate it, because they've looked at these issues, they've decided it, they've made a lot of decisions, and electronic data includes as a subset ontological data, and that may well be appropriate.
Thank you.
It's the April issue of the Communications of the ACM. I forget the exact title, but it's the European Union Provenance Project.
The Provenance of Electronic Data?
Provenance of Electronic Data, yeah.
Yeah, that's what it's called.
Okay.
I just also like to call everybody's attention to ISO 8120, which deals with provenance in the context of master data quality. And it's currently in draft status, and I can provide copies to anyone who's interested.
Okay. Yeah.
Michael Gruninger. So I guess one other point to kind of consider is a couple of attempts at ontology repositories in the recent past and why they didn't work. I mean, there was Ontolingua, which may have been too early to kind of gain momentum. But I guess the other one that Barry also likes to mention, too, is the, I guess it was the daml.org collection of ontologies, which was quite haphazard. a lot of duplication. And so if we look at some of those, like those two examples as kind of almost counterexamples to see, you know, what lessons could we learn from those.
So daml.org has 39 different ontologies of agent, some of which differ in that they use uppercase A rather than lowercase A. There is also something called schema web, which is full of sometimes embarrassing ontologies for rock music collections and pets. And one ontology, which is my favorite, which is called a kissology, which is has only one term, accompanied by a large amount of poetry.
Right, right.
Okay. It's perfect RDF.
So, right, so then the question is, how can we, what quality, what gatekeeping criteria do we need to prevent those from,
that's,
from
see,
what we're doing becoming
that,
those?
That is exactly why we're discussing the second, because all the gatekeeping criteria so far, mentioned so far, were not content related. Oh, but so the question is, do we need one, and if so, what is the exact formulation? And that's something we will discuss later. I want to mention before, one moment. I want to mention that another gatekeeping criteria we did discuss until this morning was the question whether an ontology repository only needs to deal with types or should also allow instances. That was surprisingly didn't occur to anybody during the discussion earlier. So we might want to add that as well. I don't know whether there is a consensus on that. Ravi
here. Mine is a little bit twisted argument. The open has one restriction, namely.
We are not in the open.
You're not discussing open?
We're not discussing open. I wanted to move on, but suddenly people shot their hands.
You are into quality now?
Well, let's just start with open, and I try to summarize the two discussions, the result of the discussion before we start in the general discussion of the openness thing. Okay? So, there are two positions that I've seen, and the bad thing about, let's start with this. First, this is the strong position. We should require, see that as a parenthesis, we should require that any ontology in the open repository is based on open standards, is created and maintained in a cooperative, transparent process, is everybody can participate in the process.
Yeah.
The ontology is accessible to everybody, and the ontology is open source, where Peter might, depending whether it's necessary, give us a short introduction what exactly open source means in this context. So this was the strong openness requirement, and there were several people who argued against that. Unfortunately, Matthew Best, who is the most was the strongest proponent against that, was not here, and Pat Hayes, who also argued against it very strongly, was also not here, so I tried to do my best to make their present the position. They're saying, okay, openness should be encouraged but not required from the ontologies which are submitted to the repository. And thus the OR should be open for ontologies that are not open in all aspects mentioned above. And metadata can be used to indicate which openness criteria are fulfilled to what degree.
Could you explain the first item, openness is not required, even though you're putting it in an open ontology repository?
Well, their argument was, what is the benefit of excluding ontologies? For example, let's go back to the criteria which were presented. I'm building an ontology of supply chain networks right now. I sincerely don't want anybody to interfere with it because it's hard enough anyhow. So it's not an open process because basically I decide what's going to be in it. If this is made as a gatekeeping criterion, I won't be allowed to publish this ontology in the repository. It might, in spite of the fact that it's not created in an open process, it might be valuable to other people. It seems that there's a loss of opportunity.
So what you're talking about, it seems, is different attributes or different parts of the processes to which this term could be or not applied. Is that correct?
What we had was the situation that people said, okay, the ontologies in the open repository need to be open. And the next question was, okay, what do we mean by open? And open has different aspects, and so this was, I think Peter characterized openness with the help of these five criteria. So this is kind of the strongest formulation of open. You could arguably say that ontology, which is open source, is open in some sense. But this is, I went now in the summary for the strongest position and said, okay, open means this. It has to meet these criteria. So the discussion which we need to have is, should we demand from every ontology which is in the repository to meet all these criteria? Is sufficient to meet a subset of this criteria? Or as Matthew West argued, we don't really need that. It's sufficient that people provide the metadata that allow us as users to see which criteria are fulfilled, but if they are not open in either of these, none of these ways, that's fine too.
Okay. Yep. As somebody who works with Matthew on an almost weekly basis,
okay,
I suffer the same issues. We've been through 2 years, maybe 3 years, of working on ISO 8000 and ISO 22745, which is about an open technical dictionary. So this issue we've been through in spades. What we came down to in the end was that particularly within the ISO standards, you can't dictate a business model, right? You set certain criteria. What we ended up with is defining what we meant and allowing people to comply or not comply, but to label themselves. So ISO 8000 says, for example, and ISO 8110, is the syntax itself must be available, must be published somewhere available. Then you have compliance classes in terms of, as far as the metadata is concerned, is the metadata available for fee or for free? Now, in all cases, it says in the standard that to be ISO 8000 compliant, the data must not create a joint work. So we've got everybody to agree that don't even try to be ISO 8000-110 compliant if you intend to push your license into somebody else's data. So everybody at least recognized on an international basis that was bad news and they would agree to bar that. But they didn't want to exclude business models that generate revenue from the resolution of, you know, metadata. Much as I think that's a bad idea, that's not my choice, it's their business model. So what we ended up with was clear labeling. So it says that if you are using what we call fee-based encoding, which is about as generous as we could come to, then your data must be clearly labeled as fee-based encoded. If it's not so labeled, and it is labeled as compliant with 8110, in that case, it's assumed to be free. So the default, if you don't label it, is free. So if you do want fee-based encoding, you can do so. That's how we came around to a solution, and that got, after a lot of hard work, international consensus, that everybody agreed that that was acceptable. Of course, those who agreed to it at the end said, but that means everybody's going to know that my data is fee-based encoded, so nobody's going to want it. The answer is, yeah, we know that. Right? But, you know, at least I think you can get to the position where it's clear to everybody what they're getting. But you can't rule out certain business models, and that's one thing we came up with. So, but ISO 8110 was published last week. You can get a copy of it. It's only 5 pages. It's not hard to read, but if you ever work with Matthew, there's blood, sweat, and tears in every single word in that document.
Yeah, Fabian, we talked a little bit this morning a couple times about important ontologies in biomedicine, one of which is SNOMED, which is proprietary, and one of which is the Unified Medical Language System, Metathesaurus, which is proprietary and actually has a very complicated licensing agreement. They're open. UMLS is open in the sense that the metadata are available, but there's a complex license because the content that the metadata reference are all proprietary. I think we can't get around the fact that a lot of the ontologies that we would want to put in a repository are not going to be open in the sense that we would like. And one of the value adds that the repository is going to provide, if not the actual content, will be the metadata, the mappings among ontologies. And so, for example, even if SNOMED were something that would require a licensing arrangement for a user to access through a repository, mappings between existing ontologies that are open and SNOMED would be invaluable. So I think when we look at the value of having closed versus open content, it's important to remember that it's not just the ontologies per se, it's the whole shebang. It's the metadata which actually makes the repository valuable in the first place. And I think often we're going to have situations where the content that we would like to have open is not, but we'll have metadata which is open, which may be very useful to people.
Mm-hmm. So this is a strong argument for actually not requiring openness as a gatekeeping criteria. I think Barry was first.
Just that we have this rule that that ontologies should be well specified and properly labeled, and this might apply also to the open ontology repository. And secondly, I would repeat what I said earlier, that this is going to be hard everywhere. And if we make it harder than it needs to be by including in the open ontology repositories either things which are not open or things which are not ontologies, then we are just the pre-programming defeat.
Well, Barry, you're a realist. Unfortunately, a lot of the ontologies that we care about, for better or for worse, are proprietary, and we can't change that. We can't pretend they don't exist.
So the strategy should be, let's build something which works, which might be smaller than we would ideally like. When we see how it works, we can then consider expanding it by including Belgium or SNOMED or something else.
Well, for example, if one is working in the field of medicine, SNOMED is proprietary and is essentially become indispensable. We can develop mappings to it. UMLS is indispensible.
But you don't need to have SNOMED in the ontology to have mappings.
No, that was my point. That was my point earlier, Pat, that even if SNOMED were... Okay, you don't have to have SNOMED in the repository. If you could include it and have the appropriate licensing superstructure, that's great. But you certainly want to have mappings to SNOMED. That goes without saying.
Just as you want to have mappings to instances and back.
Fine. Okay. Fair enough. CPT is proprietary. The AMA owns it. You couldn't imagine having a set of controlled terminologies in medicine without at least having mappings to CPT from, say, some other ontology or CPT itself. I realize that sort of makes open a strained word. But at the same time, if you're a user in a particular domain, there are certain ontologies you're going to expect to find. And the fact that others have declared them proprietary shouldn't essentially prevent the developers of the repository from making them available if there's some way to do that.
Right. Yeah, well, I think having a mapping to a proprietary ontology
should not prevent the copyright
problem. He can't
hear you, Pat.
So to have a mapping to a proprietary ontology should not present any copyright problems.
That's what I would think.
Yes.
I try to be to not ignore Ravi for another 5 minutes. You said you wanted to say something earlier.
One sentence. It's a little bit off the thread now, which is going on, because at that time it was appropriate. The open implies two restrictions. Person should be identifiable and authenticable. Second, they should conform to the security requirement of the repository. That's all.
Yeah, as qualification of the open access. Okay. I think you were...
Just one quick follow-on, and I hear it being talked around. The piece that you have to watch out for is the metadata. I think the ontologies... and building mappings to other ontologies, I don't think you're going to have problems on copyright issues there, but just be really careful about the metadata you use to link things. That's where the intellectual property sits, because it's easy to identify. It's like a DNA. You can actually trace where this came from and who owns this, and then that gets into your systems. You know, if it goes into your ontology and it's proprietary metadata, your ontology is a joint work. So be very careful. The ontologies are not the issue. It's the metadata, and you've talked about it enough. Just keep focused on that part.
Natasha.
Thank you. So I think there are actually three levels here that we're talking about, and we're kind of someone talking about one jump and someone about the other. So one is whether the content is open or proprietary. So that's one thing. And the other one, which and that's one issue, but I think in my point of view, it's actually even more dangerous, is the requirement that the only ontologies that an open repository should allow are the ones that everybody can contribute to. Pat Hayes made that argument very eloquently. I cannot do it nearly as eloquent as he did. But the point was, if someone develops a great ontology that everyone wants to use and makes it available under the Creative Commons license and says, no, I'll hear your feedback. I may or may not do anything. It's not transparent. You know, I'll publish a new version. I'll tell you when it is. I don't see any reason not to make that available in the repository if it's available. I mean, it's a different issue of proprietary versus open source, but that part, I think, is really dangerous if restricted to. We'll basically just lose a lot of really good ontologies.
I agree. I
don't see that as being included in there.
Well, the everybody can participate in the process of...
Essentially, two and three, a cooperative and transparent process, and everybody can participate, really talks about that.
I think it has much to do with how you understand an ontology. If you consider ontology just as a piece of software which does something for you, then you don't want a transparent process, and you don't want other people to be involved. If you understand an ontology as a standards document, then... and the thing looks very different. So I agree that.
Just a quick question also, since we're so hung up on, we see how difficult the open defining open is. That first thing, what is an open standard?
The way I understood that is it is a language which is not proprietary. So I'm not allowed, for example, OntologyWorks has ontologies which are wrote in their own language, and they wouldn't be accepted because they're not based on an open language.
It's funny because for a first long time I thought open referred to the repository, and I hadn't thought much about open as referring to the ontology. I think you can have an open repository which has metadata describing closed ontologies. And that is yet a very valuable function. So to know that something exists and to have a pointer to it and then realize you have to pay or something if you want to use it seems to me to be a perfectly valid notion of an open repository or even an open ontology repository.
Peter wants to say something.
Oh, Peter, I'm sorry.
Excuse me. Maybe with a show of hands, let's find out who in this group has actually released, let's say, an open source software or released content under a Creative Commons license. Okay, a little less than half. I promise Barry and Fabian, if there's less than half of the people, maybe I could sort of go through a 50,000 feet overview of open, free and open. So for those who had put up their hand, if I said something wrong, just kill me afterwards. And for those who have not released open source or software or Creative Commons open content, maybe these things are fairly confusing. I mean, it's sometimes even confusing to the open source people. Yes.
Yeah, Peter, I think that's a super idea, and you ought to do it. And our friends at MITRE provided the free and open source software that you're referring to generically to the Department of Defense as a policy direction about 5 years ago now. And there's still that resistance across the government in certain communities about even recognizing it, let alone getting to the understanding that Peter's going to walk us through in a moment. So I'd like to ask what your comment is on how to, again, to go back to the original, the first question of the earlier session, which our friend over here followed up talking about definitions, which is driver for all of this, agreeing on the definitions. I'd like to go back to those barriers and ask for your comment as we move to Peter's suggestion.
Well, I have two comments. One is I think we really need independent, objective measures and metrics and measurements for ontology evaluation. That being said, I mean, that's a whole research topic, and as was alluded to, we had a meeting on this topic. Aside from that, I'm at MITRE just under a year, so I can't take any credit for that, but I can defer to possibly
okay,
to
it's an
my,
open world.
Well, to Leo, I to you?
Yeah, I'm not to blame either.
That's fast.
No, there's a lot of things that have been released through MITRE, and you know, in general, we try to be non-proprietary and to release things except when there's restrictions by our government sponsors. But again, there is a range of openness that, and we admit this. So I don't really want to, alter this conversation, but we believe in strongly in openness, but we know that there's a couple of definitions out there, and we want to make sure that people are compatible with a definition they choose.
I don't know that Mark. I'm not sure that we've actually addressed the question. So what
we just mentioned degrees of openness, and Mark Musin had an interesting idea about, do we want to declare openness at the meta level, or will that be exclusive of some particular interests, but maybe engineer rules that will generate degrees of openness within the architecture once people decide it's comfortable to come and play.
Okay. Could I ask Peter just to give, just in the interest of time, because we have so much ground to cover, could you just give the short introduction to 50?
Could Mark finish his comment?
Yes, please.
Oh. I was just going to say that from a pragmatic perspective, openness is much preferred, because actually if you have proprietary content at all, managing the licenses for all those proprietary items becomes a nightmare. And so I can see why one would prefer not to actually have to deal with that part of the world. But I think we're going to have to deal with it because it's not going to go away.
My turn? Okay, a couple of disclaimers. First of all, I'm not wearing the Ontolog hat here. Ontolog, I mean, to me, is an open advocacy group besides other things. But OOR, the OOR initiative is only incubated by Ontolog for the time being before it gets funded. So the OOR initiative should not be looked at as part of Ontolog. And secondly, I promise our co-chairs that I will just give an overview to make sure the definitions are clear. So I'm not selling that position either. So that said, thanks to Natasha for starting us already. So the first layer to identify is proprietary versus free and open. So proprietary is something some company or owns rights, and either patent rights, copyrights, and so on, that they could charge you money for if they want to, or they could stop you from using. And free and open is sort of the other end of the spectrum. And then I guess if it's Richard Stallman, then he'll tell you, be clear about the word free. So it's like free as in free speech and not free as in free beer. So people can offer you things that are free when it is not sort of by the open source of free and open standard as being really free. So it could be free of charge and not really be free. So that should be an important point to note. So the next thing comes down to IPR. Intellectual property rights. There's public domain, which is not protected by IPR, which means anybody can do anything. All the rights have been relinquished to the open, to sort of the public.
and then there are IPR issues. Actually, interestingly enough, both proprietary and free and open software depends on the existing IPR regime to protect it. So it's not that free and open has no IPR, it's just that it has a set of licenses that allows a different way that the users can use them. So down one level into the open licenses, there are essentially sort of two major thinkings along that line. There are academic licenses, I mean, I'm talking about free and open licenses. There are academic licenses and there are reciprocal licenses. This comes from the perspective of whether you are thinking of freedom to the user or freedom to the work itself. If you're thinking of freedom to the user, then most of the academic, quote-unquote, licenses falling under the academic licenses, like Apache, Mozilla, and a bunch of those, BSD and so on, are academic licenses, which generally, besides requiring that you pay attribution to the original authors, does not require any reciprocation. And then there are the reciprocal licenses. Of course, best known is the GPL license in GPL version 2 and now the slightly more complex GPL version 3 licenses, which requires the extensions of anything that's extended from GPL work to further be reciprocated with the same license. Which, I mean, to some people, that's sort of the viral license. When you started out with a GPL license, the work continues to be free, so nobody can sort of in between sort of snatch it and then make it proprietary in between. But, I mean, with an Apache license, people can actually take that work and then create a proprietary product out of it. And then, of course, by IPR, I mean, I've already mentioned that there are sort of copyrights and software patents for the protection in software and for creative for content. A lot of the work has been sort of outlined by the Creative Commons, which has like six major licenses. And I have already made a post earlier to the list with all the references. So that's all I have to say. So anything that I have missed, I would hope someone would jump in and help.
I want to thank Peter for the brief introduction to open source. Open source is. Like intellectual property, the way I see it, I've been doing some work in a bit of this and a bit of that, is definitely one aspect of openness, but is not the only aspect. Another one is the cooperative, the collaborative development, et cetera, et cetera. What I wanted to point out and make a comment on for the record is that when we are discussing openness, either in terms of ontology, of which I outlined some requirements on a page, and ontology repository, which we're talking about here now, I think it's important to keep in mind, by definition, what I don't think we can define openness here as such. We have to look outside of what we are doing and look at what openness is elsewhere, in a way. There is open documents, open content, open standards, open education, open knowledge, open everything these days. I've got a list of all the open things that are happening. And the intellectual property aspect of that is very important because all these open things that are happening, thanks to the network, thanks to the technology that is letting us interchange constantly, they're increasing this openness opportunity, which is growing constantly. So I just wanted to say that openness is, in order to be able to not define openness, but at least to perceive some of its reach, we need to look at all the open things that are happening everywhere, And this openness which is being created can help us shape the openness in our ontologies and repositories, and is also influencing the law. And this is what's happening with the copyright law and with the creative licenses. So because these things are happening, people are exchanging, people are copying without attribution. And people are saying, no, we need attribution. You can copy, but you need to. People are using, reusing. It's happening. It's a de facto thing. Then the law is adapting by creating new types of licensing, isn't it? So the point is openness. When we define our open ontologies or open repositories, we should also look at the openness of knowledge in general and all the way it's manifesting, so that we can learn and relate. And then we can talk about openness. I think to be talking about openness or trying to define it within a closed environment would defeat the purpose.
I try to, let me put it this way. I'm afraid that now the discussion gets too broad in the sense of now we're talking about openness in general. And that's, I mean, the time is over anyhow, but or almost, but that was not really the purpose. The purpose here is not a general discussion of openness. The purpose is what are the minimal criteria that any ontology has to meet in order to be admitted into an ontology repository. And so it seemed to me that actually the majority of things, openness shouldn't be a criterion. It shouldn't be a minimal requirement. There should be rather something like well-defined metadata for the different kinds of openness in the different ways that you mentioned, and people then can use the annotate their ontologies and can make clear what comes with it. Is it maintained in an open process? Is it freely available, et cetera, et cetera? So just as I would like to have just everybody raise their hands who would like to support a gateway criterion which excludes everything which is not open in all of these ways. So you, again, since I said it very complicatedly, you agree... You agree to this list as minimal requirements.
That's just, you said that's position one.
Yeah, that's position one. Right.
Is that position 1.2?
Okay, that is... are there... Now I make 1.1b. who has a position that maybe not all of these, but a subset of these? Okay, that's a considerably. And who believes in position two? That means no openness requirements. Matthew is not here. Ah. Okay, only. So there is. It seems to me that.
The notion you stated about at least recording which of those you met.
In position two, which I have on this slide, is. It should be not required, but the recording of what in which aspect you are open, that is required. The metadata is required.
I like that.
So, okay. Peter?
A teaser for tomorrow. In the afternoon, there's a OOR team presentation, and I actually was sold by Mike Dean, who had come up with a sort of proposed set of roadmaps that actually does mitigate a lot of the issues that we were discussing. So hold your breath, and something interesting is coming out. And in the interest of a broader goal, he even sold me on giving up on some of these.
Okay. So, well, it seems that there is a consensus that to ask for everything here is too much, but to ask for a subset of these seems to be the consensus. And now we would have to discuss which rules exactly, but we are going to be out of time for that, so we're not doing it. Okay, so that was the first discussion topic. The other one was, do we need a quality gatekeeping criterion? The KISS ontology, if submitted with the required metadata and all, you know, specified in a good syntax and etc., would meet the gateway criteria which were listed a few slides back. Barry doesn't like the KISS ontology for good reason. So, and I think his position is we definitely need to filter this kind of ontologies out. And so, I will proceed with presenting the two positions on that. Actually, Barry is going to present the other one. I'm presenting the everything goes with a position, which is ontologies should be rejected and excluded if they do not fulfill the gateway criteria. So there needs to be a board which enforces that. And ontologies can, of course, be deleted for other reasons. For example, for copyright violations. If somebody submits an ontology and the authors didn't agree to the ontology being submitted, that's obviously a good candidate for deletion. And I also would argue that we need a way of retiring ontologies if they are not longer maintained and if they are outdated. Well, retiring just doesn't necessarily mean deleting the ontology, but just put a label on it and say it's retired.
Can I make a clarification here?
Yeah.
Your title says no quality control, whereas the first statement says they are rejected or excluded.
Well,
like quality control. I'm
yeah, but the distinction I make is quality control and the gateway criteria that I had presented before have nothing which talk about the content.
Oh, okay.
So if you look at that, openness is not a content criteria. It has to do with license and the process it's created. The formal syntax is not a content. Okay?
Let's say other criteria.
And the problem is, of course, you can create an ontology which is meets all these gateway criteria, but is really of no value to anybody. Poetry, like Barry said. Yeah. So, the position, one position was ontologies should be deleted for formal reasons or retired for formal reasons, but not. And the poor quality itself is not a reason to exclude an ontology from the repository. The argument is here: might look valueless to somebody might be of some value to somebody else. And if it starts out in a bad shape, it might be improved just because there are comments by the users. And Barry, I think you can do your.
All right.
So this is the point raised earlier by Mike Gruninger. There are already ontology repositories which failed. And one of the reasons why they failed, I think we both believe, is that they're full of crap. And they're full of crap, even though the crap itself is going to meet all of the gatekeeping criteria. There are some good things in Schema Web, but most of it is not serious in my view. So another reason for imposing tougher criteria, content-based criteria or quality-based criteria, is the same reason that I've advanced already. This is a very large exercise that we're embracing, and it's better to succeed at doing parts of it than to fail at doing all of it. And so we need to try and make the exercise constrained as far as possible. And one way of constraining it in such a way as to raise the likelihood that we will succeed is to impose quality criteria. Now, these are just two examples, both of which I think would help to make the exercise more easily achievable, and which would also mean that people would be more likely to use it because it would be a better thing. So the first one is that the metadata themselves would be tested in light of whether the ontologies themselves meet the claims made. So this seems to me to be a quite reasonable sort of quality constraint. It means that the metadata should include claims about what the ontology is supposed to do, which the KISS ontology does not do. You should look at it. Secondly, I think that one of the reasons why the DAML ontology repository is so bad is again, because it's full of the same thing over and over again, just with slightly different syntax. And so I would like to propose a second rule, which is that if an ontology is submitted to the repository and it overlaps significantly with an ontology which is already in there, then the submitter should provide metadata justifying why it needs to be included. And this might be metadata of the form, the ontology you already have is problematic for these and these reasons, and therefore we need this thing which it fixes those problems. And he's nodding his head, so at least I have one person in the room who's on my side. And everyone else is quiet, so we can just talk amongst ourselves.
Well, no, I think a nice thing I like about the first point is that it kind of moves the onus of the quality onto the claims. So it's not like you're evaluating these ontologies against some abstract kind of framework that maybe people don't agree on, but it's people would back up their claims, and you're evaluated on how well the ontology you deliver backs up the claims you make. And it's the same way students get evaluated on presentations. It's not necessarily on what, it's not the content itself that's being evaluated. It's how well they present that particular case or whatever. So that's what I like about the first point.
Natasha.
So I have several concerns with this policy, but two of my main concerns are, first, the quality of ontology, and even whether or not it satisfies the claims, is still subjective. And, I say this ontology covers this domain, and you think, no, it doesn't. And we may disagree, and, and if you're the gatekeeper, you would exclude my ontology because you think of this domain in somewhat different terms. Second is the maintenance issue, and it's the issue of who the gatekeepers are going to be. How is this sustainable? These are my two main concerns. And also for the second point, in terms of, if you're second on this domain, you have to justify why you're including this. I think this whole notion that, I got there first, so I'm more correct, is a little bit disconcerting to me, at least. So, there was no ontologies in a particular topic.
So that's unfair. We don't give any special rights to the people who got there first.
Well, you're not going back to the person who already has the ontology and say, now you have to justify why your ontology should still stay there.
Oh, but that might be one consequence. In fact, that's likely to be a consequence. Why would you produce a new ontology of X if there already is an ontology of X, unless you think that you can produce a better ontology of X, which means that you shame the original creator?
I don't think so. I could take a different...
Well, sadly, you're probably right. But then that means that we all the more need to have some side of...
This would be the argument,
because the Daml list is not just ugly, it wastes people's time, because they have to go through 39 different ontologies of agent to find out whether there's even one good one.
I completely agree with you on that point, but I think we don't know why the Daml repository failed. It could be because it was never maintained and didn't have any value added to it.
Hypothesis. No metadata or pursuing. Yes, please.
Yes, but so really don't know why it failed. I think it's an overstatement to say that it failed.
Well, let's find out objectively why it failed.
How?
Yes, indeed. Let's do so, and let's do that by subjecting the ontologies in the repository to intersubjective criticism. I think the second... I agree with Natasha here. I think the second point, Barry, you have to have it. You have to choose which way here. Either that's preferring the first one in, or it's trivial. And there's no. That's the only alternative.
I think it's trivial. Actually. I think everything.
But then it serves no purpose at all. If it's not giving preference to the first one in, then it's satisfiable by any kind of metadata statement somebody wants to make. So I can't really see what it's doing. But let me also suggest
it's forcing people to think twice before they submit the 39th agent ontology.
And let me suggest that can be accomplished by two things, neither of which the DAML repository or any of the other failed ones that I know of had. The first is the already mentioned mechanisms by which social evaluation mechanisms by which people can comment on what they found and submit reviews and so forth that are visible in the repository.
To all 39 that have,
I don't think too many people would be looking past the first few with that have some thumbs up on them. But let me say the other element that was missing from most ontologies that have been out there is real-world application usage. And the weight of evaluation by attempted use is going to be far greater than any theoretical evaluation of quality, which we are far, far, far from being able to
do.
I agree.
So I think I like to keep time, and we only have 1 minute and 33
I really want to speak
seconds.
For, I really want to speak
so
for
Mark, quickly.
To follow up on your comment about the weight of effective new use of ontologies and semantic interoperable approaches in healthcare, for example, one of Barry's favorite topics. How do we stand, Barry, to follow up on her point, comparing the use of reference information model in its current state of evolution of HL version 3, as you've debated in the past and ongoing, to ontology, maybe better solutions? How do we compare now in that big arena of healthcare? Using HL version 3, HL 7 version 3 versus ontology software.
To generalize your question just a little bit, I think
to
Natasha.
Follow up on her
yeah, but
point.
Natasha made a very important point, namely, how are we going to succeed in supporting this, any kind of this, whether in the ontology, open ontology repository arena or in the healthcare arena?
Maybe that's the better question.
And my answer is. This is clip four for another version of the same argument. Whatever we try to do should be relatively small and constrained because we won't have the resources even to do that thing well. And if we try and do the whole thing, then not only will we be faced with... It's 4 o'clock, it says. Not only will we be faced with all the technical problems of making the thing work, but we will also not have the resources to even be there when it fails. So he's in charge now.
Yeah, I like to keep time. I like to keep time. I need to look to see which who is in charge overall. But I mean, being a German, it's ingrained in my genes that I want to be on time. So let's just go to the next speaker. I'm sorry I have to interrupt, but... You know, we all want to have dinner at some time, and we have a long evening with the presentations after dinner. Even.
Yeah, but Barry asked the question, and we need to answer that, right? I mean, Barry asked, how
Barry
are we going to maintain
it? A rhetorical question.
No, that's, and I'm going to give an authority answer at this stage. I mean, you cannot just ask a question and then let us go home with the question. Let's try to answer. Give us five more minutes.
You have the last word. And
no, I mean, I'm sorry because there were a chap there who has, he wants to speak. They're the Chinese guy. And there were a few more people before me, but there is something I really want to say. So I'll say after them.
Thanks for giving me some time to speak. I think that, first of all, I think Barry's claim on the demo library and schema web is it's correct, but also have some issues. I think it's sometimes it's wrong. In the one side, you can schema web and demo library are collecting ontologies. They are not trying to evaluate ontology and bring all the nice ontologies, present only nice ontologies to you. They present whatever you submit. So they are really truthful, presenting like it's a collection. It's one kind of ontology repository. Doesn't care about what kind of a quality it is. It's okay. And there are something like Wikipedia, like we enforce some quality control on that. If somebody do spam, vandalism, I'm going to delete that. I'm going to remove that. You won't be able to see it. And that's what you are looking for. And that's also great. I mean, that's actually more like an ontology publishing journal. So like if you want to publish an ontology through a journal, there's a peer review, it's great. So it's guaranteed to be in high quality. And finally, if we are going to enforce one ontology, so like there are Sumo ontology, which is great, open directory ontology, they are trying to unify all the ontology or saying like, if I define this kind of concept, use mine, and then you don't have to define what I have been defined. But that's not web alike. The web is like everybody can speak how they have what they whatever they want. So sometimes you and me might share the common agreement, but sometimes we are not. Even within our group, I and another postdoc in my group, we just don't agree on our ontologies. We fight and fight, and I remove his and he remove mine. And finally, we said, fine, let's separate. We define the same concept, but just share a portion of the other person's, and then I keep mine. So I'm seeing like there's not a requirement to say, we have to say, if you overlap with me, then don't submit, I just skip you. It's kind of exclusive. So the web is a place where everybody can hold their own will, and we share something at some extent.
There are a lot of very smart, busy people in...
What? If you want to have dinner tonight...
But she'll get angry if I don't respond.
No. But I am the moderator.
There are a lot of very smart, busy people in this room who think they're doing something which will be useful for the future of governments and administration.
And science and so forth. Did you hear the rest? Now, what you're suggesting is that instead of trying to build something useful that will have good qualities like that, we create a dustbin. And anyone that submits stuff will get the stuff thrown into the dustbin. I do not want to spend... You can't speak.
Barry, we have a dustbin. It's the web, right? So, I mean, and that's just quickly the point, 1 minute. If I think the open ontology repository has a certain open format which we'll agree upon, and we put it on the web, then... You know, it's going to be there for people to use. And people can build intelligent agents to use it according to their requirements, appropriate filters, whatever suits them. So I think we should aim for continuing this discussion instead of keep on putting constraints as to what we should do in a way. I think I'm saying the same thing. So like, can we find a way that we can work with what we've got? And the repository is the web, is there already. I think we should not be wasting too much time on that, unless there is some disagreement, which I would like to hear about.
Could I say something?
Sure.
Very hard, very fast. So I think we said we need metadata for the ontologies. That's something new because most of the ontologies, they don't have any metadata inside. So that's one thing that allow people to evaluate, well, if this is of good quality or not. And then a second thing, let's have the social aspect of the web. And let's say, well, Barry Smith says this is a horrible ontology. People will read it and will say, well, that's horrible. But then maybe the poeticians will come and say, this is the best ontology. It's good for them, period. But let's allow the social web and just add the model that allows people to add reviews. Anybody could add a review, right? What's the web trust and all these things, what people could say about different things. That's all what I want to say.
So two things. One is an annotated dustbin is still a dustbin. And secondly, Natasha said, who is going to carry out these quality gatekeeping kinds of mechanisms? Even to check whether the metadata is there is going to require somebody who carries out quality gatekeeping.
Is the user, having one person or a group of people doing it is very, very, very tough. Even in the works that are just controlling one
having
ontology.
Users is a good quality constraint. I would like to have in the repository only ontologies which have independent users. That was kicked around in the discussions and it was rejected.
Since my words are taken slightly out of context, I would like to correct it. So when I was saying when I was saying about who is going to do the gatekeeping, it was the second part of what I was saying, because all those qualities are very subjective, and it's going to be the subjective opinion of whoever. Even if there are resources, it's going to be a resource for a very small number of people. You know, 1, 2, 3. It's not going to be much, and it's going to be subjective. So you can take one part of my argument and keep going on with it without and ignoring the other part. It was part of the same argument.
Mark, I think you are the right person to have.
I just want to underscore what Luis just said, because it's really important, and that it's really the users who matter. And then Barry, of course, brings out the high school debater in me, which I guess is either good or bad. But when you look at the ontology repositories that have failed, I think the thing that underscores both the ones that with which I'm most familiar is a lack of use. The DAML ontology library was never meant to be used by anybody. It was meant by Jim Hendler to be able to get his program to generate a whole bunch of ontologies and put them on the web. It was that no one ever put anything in the DAML library with the intention that it would really be used for anything except to demonstrate that DAML was useful for something, that is, creating this repository. And the DAML library never really had end users, and you would never expect it to have end users, and that's where all the cobwebs came from. The Ontolingua library, which of course has died, is one we look at now and say this is all old stuff, no one wants to use it, it's all junk. But you know, in its day, in the 1990s, Ontolingua was the only game in town, and people used it. They used it. Yeah, it didn't have any metadata. It was very hard to tell what was good. But a lot of those ontologies got reused because it was the only place people could go to get content. And what made the library worthwhile was the fact that it had lots of traffic. And you know that those ontologies that received the most traffic were probably at least worth looking at, even though they may be of mediocre quality. At least they were inspirational to people who wanted to use them as a basis for new systems. So I think we're back to where we were this morning, and that is it's not just the ontology content that matters in this initiative. I think what makes these repositories worthwhile is the fact that they have a user community who cares about the content and that there are metadata that can help point out what's useful and can help direct that community. But as soon as the community stops coming, as soon as the metadata become poor or non-existent, then you're going to have the cobwebs accumulate, and that's why Ontolingua is now dead, and that's why DAML was dead from the beginning.
Mark, would you agree with Barry's first criterion that there's a check against the metadata that the users provide themselves?
We can perform some kinds of checks on metadata, but I think we're still back to the problem of ontology evaluation. And the metadata may tell in text or in some logical sentence what the ontology is supposed to be good for. But until that ontology gets evaluated against whatever use cases were used to create it in the first place, the metadata can't really be evaluated except at face value. And so
But face value evaluation is...
Pardon?
Is better than nothing. I mean,
it's absolutely better than nothing. So
you would be happy with that one?
If I had metadata for the KISS ontology, I would love it. And I have to confess that even the case of the KISS ontology, because it's such a bad example, it's one of the ontologies that I cite the most, and I wouldn't want it to go away.
Oh, well, that's okay. I close the session now. Thank you, everybody, for your spirited argument. All
right. Well, debate is better than silence. This is good. So, with deference to Michael, who is going to present the ontology of ontologies, right? Session, something like that. We're still shooting for a 5:15 or so close. So we'll see if we make it.
Sorry about that, Michael.
No, you want to keep discussion going.
Yes, sir.